I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and I'm a journalist. Join me on my new podcast, But We Loved, coming May 15th, where queer elders recount the amazing history they've lived through.
In the middle of Wall Street, they stopped traffic. They were doing a die-in.
And in the process, share little gems of wisdom for the next generation.
The key is to understanding yourself, learning to love and embrace yourself.
You can listen to But We Loved May 15th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Do we have a hashtag for this podcast?
We do.
Yeah, what is it?
It's called hashtag... Blow the mind, protest, whoa, protesting in a digital age.
Oh, okay.
I think that's going to fly.
A good one. I don't know if we're going to have enough room for the rest of the tweet, but it's pretty good. We'll try that out.
Yeah, we'll work on that. No, but this we're talking about today.
I'm pretty sure we get to own that hashtag. We don't have to.
I don't think anybody's going
to. It's not going to be like when I tried to retake blew my mind.
Yeah.
From the rest of the Twitterverse.
That's right.
But yeah, we're talking in this podcast specifically about Occupy Wall Street and some of these other social media enhanced protest movements that have taken hold in late 2010 and then throughout 2011, ranging from the Arab Spring to London to back here in the U.S. with the Occupy stuff. And of course, the Occupy stuff has bled over into other countries as well.
But we're talking about what is a modern protest? What does it look like these days?
How is the modern protest shaping up? I mean, protests have always utilized advanced technology to whatever degree it's available. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just the way we work. So it's no surprise that people are going to use modern technology, modern social media to fuel the movement. But let's back up before we get into the technology
right.
of things. Just talking about numbers because
people by the numbers.
Yeah, because when we're talking about hashtags being heard around the world, to a certain extent, we're talking about the number of people involved in that protest. Because I mean, the people observing a protest are arguably as important as the individuals that are partaking in it, because it has to be seen. To really take that effect. That's
right.
The whole point is to convey the importance of a topic.
And to put a little context behind that, too, we're talking about the hashtag Occupy Wall Street, which showed up on July 13th, right? It's just this sort of idea linking to a blog about, hey, we should occupy Wall Street. There was no formal movement at that time or even intention.
So the Earth we live on is currently home to, what, 7 billion people now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we just had the 7 billionth birth last couple of weeks.
Can you imagine being like, hey, I'm baby, 7 billion.
Well, Yeah,
I would hope my parents would call me 7 billion.
Yeah, 7 billion would be the baby's name. These billions and billions of people, roughly spread across 240 countries, mm-hmm. close to 7,000 languages around like
documented,
six,
yeah, right?
Documented languages. Yeah, somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,912. And more branches of religion, personal belief, ideology than you can shake a stick at.
Yeah, 20 major, but you're right. There's quite a bit more than that.
Yeah, and we continue to grow. We continue to, in some cases, splinter and reorganize amid those groups.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to get these people together? Because I was talking with my wife the other day about a recent episode of This American Life where they're talking about junior high and how mm-hmm. junior high is horrible and how one of the things going on in junior high is that when you're young, you get along with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But then as you get older, just within school, you become more judgmental. You become more perceptive to, who you want to be associated with and who you want to identify with.
Yeah, you've created this blueprint of reality in your
right.
brain.
And so by junior high, it's already pretty complicated. So how do we ever agree on anything?
How do we get out of high school mentality?
Right. And, historically, wars are generally a pretty good way to do it. Wars have long brought together millions of individuals in pitched battles.
Mm-hmm.
It's thankfully, hopefully, seems to be going out of style in recent years.
Because technology
has changed
the
way that we wage war.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe there's something going on in our collective psyches as well.
The better angels of ourselves.
We can hope. I've seen some interesting arguments to that we live in a time where there's less war now than ever before. So let's hope the trend keeps up until the big machine human war.
Right.
But
the singularity.
Yeah, but that's going to bring us all together even more. It's hard to put stats on some of these ancient battles, but 480 BC, the Persian army marched into the Battle of Thermopylae with between 200,000 and 500,000 men. More than 2,000 years later, in 1943, the Soviet Union's Red Army suffered more than 1 million casualties at the Battle of Stalingrad.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have other examples where we can see people converging for a cause that is not bloodthirsty and drenched in hardship.
Right.
January 2007, an estimated 60 million Hindu pilgrims gathered at the convergence of the Ganges and Yamuna rivers in northern India for the Ardh Kumbh Mela festival.
Mm-hmm.
A huge festival. You've probably seen clips of this, individuals bathing in the rivers. And
yep. It's sort of an act of purity, right?
Yeah, an act of purity. 60 million people coming together for that, which is
amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So protests also bring people together. And this is the,
right.
And we just recorded a podcast about this, so it should already be in your iTunes folder or hanging out on the web for you to listen to if you want a little more information about why we get into the protest mentality. But once we are there, we can gather in rather large numbers sometimes.
Right. And the reason why Occupy Wall Street has, I think, some legs or has had legs, at least over the past 4 months. Mm-hmm. We don't, again, know what its fate is now. It has the classic earmarks of a protest. So we're talking about disenfranchised people, right?
Yes, check.
Crappy economy.
Check.
Uh-huh. And stagnating politics.
Oh, double check.
Right. Yeah. So this is pretty much a global situation right now, right? So it's
right.
not just in the United States, group of people in New York starting this. That's why it has, such resonation all over the world. And of course, we've seen this before. We've seen it with Vietnam, right?
Mm-hmm.
A little bit different circumstances, but we have people who are saying that there are wrongs that need to be righted. We've seen it with the Arab Spring.
The Arab Spring being just the string of protest and mm-hmm. in some cases actual rebellion revolution
mm-hmm.
Situations that has just spread throughout various countries in the Middle East, ranging from we've seen the protests in Iran,
mm-hmm.
Tunisia, Egypt, Libya.
Mm-hmm. I mean, really, it points to the fact that people will put up with a lot of crap until it gets to the point where it's making them powerless in their day-to-day decisions on whether or not to buy groceries
mm-hmm.
or, buy new shoes or, it's hamstringing them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we can put up with a lot of corruption, a lot of political hooey until that happens.
All right, we're going to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors, and then we're going to really break down the question, what is the largest protest of all time?
And what factors made it that way?
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel, the sponsors of tomorrow, and the Discovery Channel. At Intel, we believe curiosity is the spark which drives innovation. Join us at curiosity.com and explore the answers to life's questions.
All right, we're back. Largest protest. This is something that is sometimes very difficult to gauge because not every protest consists of individuals gathering in a square.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's hard to count sizes. And you're going to get into the wars of information and politics of information, too, where the protesters may in some cases want to inflate the number because it sounds better. And then the people cracking down on the protests are likely to lower that number for obvious reasons.
You know what? It just occurred to me. Why don't they use the same technology that NASA does to count the constellations that they then applied to tracking dolphins?
Well, true. That's true. You could use some sort of sophisticated data. But then if you're the people who has that technology, it's going to tend to be the governmental forces. So they're not going to necessarily want an accurate count anyway, not for public consumption. The other thing, think back to in the other podcast we mentioned Mahatma Gandhi and the whole some of the civil disobedience that was going on there with individuals protesting by not showing up for work or by resigning from their positions. You get into protests of that nature and it becomes even more difficult to gauge what the turnout is.
Because they're protesting in ways in which they are not visible.
When you're getting down into actual numbers, though, and you can say, like, well, this is the number of individuals that we know of that participated in this, and therefore this is a very large or the biggest protest. One of the big ones, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, was the Iraq protest in Rome, February 15th, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
The event drew a crowd of estimated 3 million people, and on the same day, protesters gathered in nearly 600 cities in a coordinated global effort to express moral outrage against the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So you had like 1.3 million protesters in Barcelona, Spain, between 750,000 and 2 million in London. All told, according to BBC, between 6 and 10 million people participating in a global protest.
Which is amazing because think about, when we talked about the civil rights movement and we talked about Rosa Parks and how her refusal to give up a seat to a white person then spurred a 381-day boycott of the bus system, right? Mm-hmm. And this was something that was in the works forever. I mean, there were a lot of people working on this specific plan and other ones for months and months and months. And then you have something like this, between 6 and 10 million people protesting. And I'm going to wager a bit that it didn't take that long, given the data that we know about when the Iraq war broke out and when the protests happened, that people were mobilized. And so you can obviously point to really one key factor in mobilizing all those people, which is the technology we have available today.
Right.
Which really does change the landscape of protesting.
It's worth noting real quick before we get even more into the technological stuff that sometimes a protest is just as simple as a naked lady with a fur and some fake blood splattered on her, you know?
Or a naked man. Mm-hmm.
Preferably both, I guess, so you get all your demographics covered. But
that's the shock tactic,
right? The shock tactic.
That's like, hey, we want the media to cover this.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like PETA, no matter what you think about PETA, and certainly there are some very... some very contrary positions on what PETA stands for and or how they carry out their protests, but their protests tend to get attention.
They do, and I will say, you know, I've certainly walked through a PETA protest. I was walking through one in Boston with my mom when we all lived there a number of years ago, and my mom had a fake fur colored lined jacket on.
Oh no!
And of course, she was the target, but the thing that stood out is that they said, "I hope that you get cancer and die."
Oh,
yeah. So, I mean, obviously,
did they sling fake blood on her or anything?
No, they didn't.
Okay,
but that was in itself really very jarring. Obviously, and my mom, she was actually kind of oblivious. She was kind of like, "What did they just say?" And I was like, "Nothing." but you know, there are effective ways to really get at the psyche, right? And that's what protests are trying to do. So you can do it in numbers or you can do it in awful things that you say to passersby.
Yeah. And then of course there's art, there's music, protest songs, protest in our art episode that we did recently about Your Brain on Art. We mentioned like the works of Pablo Picasso talking about the Spanish Civil War and expressing that through art, expressing his outrage and varied emotions about this political situation through the expression of art. So.
You know, and I'm thinking too about the protest of the Iraq war, and obviously this is before Twitter and Facebook, and this isn't a question that we can answer today or anytime soon, but you know, I do wonder how it would impact or would have impacted that protest. Do you think more people would have participated? Do you think that it would have attenuated it in some way because it might have taken focus away? And we certainly know that the protests of late have been really effective because of these technologies.
Yeah, it's real effective for a number of reasons. But I mean, because A, it's instant networking. It's social networking. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to throw something out with that hashtag, Occupy Wall Street, and then everybody following that hashtag can instantly see what's up. Real-time information in all of its effective and, in some cases, perplexing manner. You know,
right,
I mean, it's
right.
the real-time aspect of it, I think, is really key. Because you could be like, suddenly somebody's tweeting, hey, the police are cracking down.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving into this area, and everybody knows.
Yeah.
And it's also allowed certain groups to even it allows you this huge voice without necessarily having any huge investment in the megaphone,
mm-hmm.
in the metaphorical megaphone, mm-hmm. or the real megaphone, you know? Like, not quite a protest, but just consider with all the crackdowns that have occurred on WikiLeaks, a lot of their continued momentum has taken place on Twitter, where they've continued to be able to speak out to all of these followers despite bank accounts and websites going down around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't help but think about the protests in Iraq or the protests of the Iraq war and 10 million people mobilized via email, right? That's a huge coordinated global effort, just what it might have looked like with these different technologies that we use today.
Right. Of course, people have been studying the impact of social media on protests and movements prior to all of this. I actually spoke to this guy by the name of Dr. Michael Best, who heads Technologies and International Development Lab at the Georgia Institute of Technology. I spoke to him early 2011 for an article on Discovery News called "Are Smartphones Worth It?"
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up being a lot more interesting of an article than it sounds, because I got to discuss, like, how does it affect our daily lives?
Right.
And then by talking to Best, learned a little bit about how it was specifically being used by Nigerians leading into the 2011 Nigerian election.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing a lot of political organizing. They were planning activist meetings and flash mobs,
mm-hmm.
all leading up to the election that was at least at that time slated to take place in April. And at the time, I thought it was really interesting. But then, of course, this turns out to be a major theme of 2011.
Right.
As individuals are tweeting about the various protests that they're involved in and coordinating their movements. And in all of this, I also can't help but think another advantage of social media, and specifically Twitter, has to do with the people observing. Because I feel like with Twitter, one of the things people like about celebrities being on Twitter is that you're kind of as close to that celebrity as you are to the friend, the real life friend that you know on Twitter. Like there's this closeness that's there.
Well, there's this idea that you're getting insights into how they're living and what they're thinking.
And you're all a part of the same information stream.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're observing like a real-time protest taking place on Twitter and you're seeing updates about Occupy Wall Street or the protests in Iran, whatever it may be, I feel like the people observing it on Twitter end up feeling closer and a little more personally invested
in
the movement.
It probably gives people a little bit more empathy for the movement. So if someone is sprayed with tear gas, right, and let's say that this was just an indiscriminate response by police.
Right.
And that was how it was tweeted, right?
Right.
Then people are going to say, oh my, you know, the depth of injustice here is unbearable.
Yeah.
Because you're getting real time data about this.
Right. I think it's like it's as if you were standing on the edges of a protesting crowd in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you're not actively participating in it,
mm-hmm.
you're going to feel a little more like a protest. You're going to feel more sympathetic to that cause just by virtue of being in close proximity to it. And the social media world of Twitter puts you on the edges of that crowd in a virtual sense.
Right.
So I think that the same thing ends up happening.
Well, it's such a game changer, too, for the government, because now that you do have these so much information to share, it's very easy to document the missteps that the government might take or that a police force might take against protesters. So, you know, obviously that sort of stuff came out before, but now it's pretty verifiable, particularly if you've got, you know, cell phone video of it.
Now, of course, it's worth noting that throughout these various protests and all, Twitter hasn't necessarily been the motivating force. It's not like Twitter was the real power of the movement necessarily. It certainly helped and was certainly a game changer, but take the Egyptian Revolution, January through February 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Twitter and the various social media outlets made a lot of headlines, but the television, newspapers, and telephone, specifically, like Al Jazeera, continued to be a major informer for the people, even as the Egyptian government blocked internet connections, in January. So, you know, it's worth noting that there are other media outlets in play here. And then in some cases, this was pretty interesting. This was from, February 2011. Following the uprisings in the Middle East, some individuals in China were arguing for a, quote, Jasmine Revolution.
Right, yeah.
And they were talking about it on this overseas Chinese community news site, Boxun, B-O-X-U-N. Mm-hmm. The Chinese government ended up blocking searches for Jasmine, for the term Jasmine. Mm-hmm. And they also, the website was hacked by a denial of service attack. So.
Right, right.
So that you see a little bit of this sort of digital, virtual, social media warfare that ends up taking place. Like basically the protesting situation of the crowd of protesters and the riot control taking place in a virtual realm.
Yeah, seeing it play out there. But and actually, it's worth noting too that the Jasmine Revolution really didn't have legs, right?
Right.
For that very reason that it was shut down. So, you know, looking to the future a bit, it'll be very interesting to see how China and protesting take place in the future, given the technologies and also given the fact that, you know, if you can shut down a protest that way, you can obviously have people go in and hack the other way.
Right.
So, I don't know. Just interesting thought. With that many people in one country, surely something will come out of it.
Yeah. But I guess one of the things, too, is that even as we get increasingly digital, like it seems like the idea of individuals gathering together to support a cause is going to remain a vital part of protest. Like I can't see protest going completely digital, you know, because it's kind of like on Facebook, for instance. For a while there were a string of these things where it's like, speak out against, I don't know, something like child abuse by changing your profile picture to a cartoon or something. Like there was a string of
that.
These.
Yeah.
And then finally people started saying, you know, this is kind of dumb because we're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're not actually doing anything for these causes. You're just.
It's not like you quit paying your taxes, right?
Right,
like
right.
Thoreau.
It's not like you went out in the street and made yourself known and were, I mean, there's something about people gathering in a space, generally a space they're not really supposed to be in, and speaking out as a group and saying, look at these individuals all piled here together. Look at them. Look at us.
Yeah, but not to sound too Orwellian, again, looking toward the future and thinking about facial recognition software, it could be really problematic for people in the near future to congregate. And I was just thinking about the app that came out for the Chicago bar scene using facial recognition software, which you can, you know, go by a bar and it basically is going to tell you the age range of the people in there and the relative income, which, by the way, if you've ever...
Just by looking at faces?
Yeah, from the facial recognition software.
Like you take a picture of people at the bar and then it.
Yeah, because it's indexing some sort of database that's basically saying, oh, okay, well, I mean, I don't know. If someone's wearing pearls, maybe it's, looking at that. I don't, you know, but anyway, the point is that this is a software that could be used, for crowds and you could start, you know, IDing certain people. You could tag them as a known protester. You could begin tracking them.
And this is fascinating. I could see then a situation where, say, a protest movement begins to gel together in a public space. They send a guy out with one of these devices. All he has to do is take a picture, analyze it, just a quick scan of the crowd, and then it will compare faces with the database. It will sort of judge you know, the various socioeconomic status, any possible criminal histories, and then give them a readout with advice on the next step. They could be like, oh, this is nothing to worry about. This is going to break down in a couple of hours versus go ahead and shut this down now because this is going to get bad.
Right. So right now we think about protesters facing officers who might be armored with Kevlar vests and plastic shields. And, you know, instead of bullets, they might be hit by rubber bullets, which we've seen before. You know, you've got snatch squads that will come and snatch people. And sound cannon. We've talked about this too in our Future of Pain podcast about how you can basically just scatter a bunch of people with an incredibly loud noises. Okay. Uh-huh. So you have all of that, but maybe in the future, you know, you don't have as much of a police presence, but you do have people in the crowd who are trying to shut it down by getting the data on the people and preventing them for future, you know, from participating in future protests.
Huh.
It's very likely.
It's
kind of insidious.
Yeah. This is kind of a tangent, but I can't help but be reminded. I think it's like a DJ Shadow track, from an older album where, he ended up sampling, this bit from a sermon that was taking place, in the Woodstock era. And, the preacher giving the sermon was talking, like he was describing outlandishly, like a situation where you had like hippies in kind of a protest environment and the police could not enter. They could not even like enter in to like control them because the marijuana smoke was too thick. that it was just this crowd of just out of control, sinful hippies, and they were just layered in drug smoke, so that the police couldn't go in. And
so
stop
the way
them.
To combat facial recognition software is just to have a big thick ganja cloud around.
Well, according to this guy,
according to that guy, yeah. I'm not suggesting that you're saying people should do that.
But it is.
Or are you?
Well, but no, I'm not suggesting people do that. But it just brought it to mind. But here's the thing about the facial recognition software.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody could just end up wearing masks, right? I mean, that's the whole V for Vendetta Guy Fawkes mask.
That's true.
Become increasingly a symbol, really more of a symbol of these various movements and various groups like Anonymous, et cetera, rather than just this movie based on this Alan Moore graphic novel.
Yep. You could dial down the protester profiling by doing that for
In some cases, it's illegal to wear a mask in public, officially. So
I can understand why. I was on MARTA one day and someone had a mask on. And I can't remember. It was maybe like Tigger or something.
Uh-huh.
It was so disconcerting.
Hmm.
I thought for sure, no good will come of this.
Yeah.
You know, this, yeah.
Well, when, for the Olympics that took place in China, Mexico sent a couple of luchadors, the masked wrestlers, not to actually compete, but to just sort of, I think they were doing a show there. It was just kind of a goodwill kind of thing. But they had to get special permission for them to wear their masks because they can't take their masks off. I mean, that's their identity, right? I mean, I mean, there's no point in them going over there if they can't wear their masks. They are their masks.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to get special permission from the Chinese government to wear these things.
Yeah. Well, oh, by the way, when I speak of MARTA, I'm talking about the train system we have here in Atlanta.
Yes.
In case anybody's like, what do you mean you are on MARTA? Who's MARTA?
Yeah.
That's the train system. Oh, all right. So just a little bit of food for thought. The number one indicator of civil unrest, lack of money, right?
Yes.
And then, of course, resources and political corruption. Now, keep in mind that by 2050, we're adding about 2.5 billion more people. Well, I don't know. What do you think's going to happen?
Well, I think, as with any age in the past, there will continue to be protests.
Mm-hmm.
There will continue to be situations that are worth protesting about. And hopefully, like I said at the start of the podcast, we'll continue to engage in these type of group activities rather than open warfare.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a much better prospect for sure. So there you go. What do we have in our magic mailbox there?
I don't know. Where's the robot? Oh, there he is.
Robot's always taking breaks, man.
There you go. Bring us some of that sweet listener mail. All right, here we go. We have one from a listener by the name of Jen. Jen writes in and says, "Hello, Robert and Julie. I hope this finds you well. I have been listening to your podcast for about half a year, and I've loved every single one." That's great. I haven't loved every single one.
You haven't?
No, I love every single one.
I've loved all of them except for one.
Okay.
I won't talk about it, though.
Okay. I now look forward to my long commutes because I get to listen to your entertaining and insightful conversations. I think that's why your podcast really stands out for me. You're not just delivering information to your listeners, but you are actively engaging with it and picking apart some quite complicated topics for us. Thank you for hours of entertainment. It takes my mind off of how much I'm spending on gas. As a graduate student researching medieval gender and women's history, which is pretty exciting, I particularly appreciated your October 11th podcast on evolution of and the orgasm war. I apologize for this being late. My iPod broke and I only just replaced it, so I was listening to 2 months worth of podcasts last week. Ideas about the nature of the female orgasm, especially in regard to its necessity or lack thereof for conception, was a topic of interest for doctors, church officials, and court officials alike in the Middle Ages. In fact, it had rather tragic consequences for a number of women throughout the period. Galenic medicine, the dominant theory throughout the Middle Ages, held that female orgasm was a necessary requisite for conception. It was widely believed that women also produced sperm during intercourse, and it could only be released if the woman had enjoyed herself. Consequently, a woman in the Middle Ages who was the victim of a rape resulting in pregnancy had no legal recourses in many areas of Europe. Her pregnancy belied her enjoyment of the encounter, which inherently singled her consent to the act. Well, that was a bummer. Anyway, thank you once again for your wonderful podcast, and I'm sorry that my gratitude prompted me to tell you some really sad history. You guys rule. Best. Jen. Well, that's awesome. That was very interesting and certainly kind of sad, rather insight. But, I mean, that's exploring anything about the Middle Ages.
Well, true. But it is uplifting in the sense that if you think that the female orgasm is still a mystery, just look back down and say, ah, things are... the understanding is a little bit better there.
Yeah, but you got to love the Middle Ages. So I'm excited that we have a listener who is steeped in medieval lore.
Yeah, well, and especially in gender issues.
All right, Robot, hand me another one. Here we go. Jim writes in and says, "Hi, guys. Your mind/art show reminded me of an exhibit I saw a few years ago. I took my then 8-year-old son to the MoMA in New York City on a school holiday. They had a really cool temporary exhibit. It contained something like 64 small works of art in sequential order. The concept of this exhibit was that each work related to the next one, the one next to it. For example, a Rubik's Cube was next to a drawing of a Rubik's Cube, which was next to a drawing of a cube-shaped building, which was next to a round building, etc. At one place, we came across a photo of rocks. Then there were rocks displayed as a sculpture. Then the rocks were on paper. Then there was paper. Then shredded paper. Then some scissors. Aha! Rock, paper, scissors. The exhibit came with a brochure which identified the works and artists, but there were no details about how the pieces related. This was up to the viewer. The last several items were a dangling bare light bulb that talked, a set of phrases out of any meaningful context, a film projector, a vintage photo from the balcony of a 1940s-era movie theater, a sign that said "The End," and finally, you had to check the brochure for this one, but the room's built-in exit sign was the final piece. It was really cool and fun to walk through the exhibit with my son and figure out the connections. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I've gotten to look at some art with the niece and nephew, and it is interesting to sort of prod young minds on and see them inspired by trying to figure out what art is about. And as we discussed in the podcast, that's one of the amazing things about art, how it engages with their brain on both conscious and subconscious levels.
Yeah, and was that quote from Picasso something like, he could draw like Rembrandt, but it took him... his whole lifetime to draw like a child, or think like a child, I guess is what he was saying.
So
that's really cool, and I love the idea that it's this cumulative work that you continue, like your perception is forced to reevaluate each piece that you're seeing as a whole. It's pretty trippy.
Yeah. Well, hey, if you have anything trippy you would like to share with us, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We are Blow the Mind on both of those. And we try and update both of those feeds with all sorts of cool links, both the stuff that we're working on and stuff we've done and, podcast topics, but also just cool things we find around the net. And certainly you guys are invited to share that kind of stuff as well. On more than one occasion, something you guys have shared with us has turned around and ended up being a podcast episode all on its own.
And you can always send us your thoughts via email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future,
Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and I'm a journalist. Join me on my new podcast, But We Loved, coming May 15th, where queer elders recount the amazing history they've lived through.
In the middle of Wall Street, they stopped traffic. They were doing a die-in.
And in the process, share little gems of wisdom for the next generation.
The key is to understanding yourself, learning to love and embrace yourself.
You can listen to But We Loved May 15th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.